Yeah, so this, we're not talking about movies this week. We're not talking about any movie this week. And we're also not talking about anything that came from anything that is related to anything we've ever done. This is a personal request episode.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a, I read something in school, and now we're going to talk about it.
And what did you read in school?
I read Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been? By Joyce Carol Oates.
And what class did you read this for?
My Introduction to Literary Analysis, or whatever it's called.
Introduction to Literary Analysis? So,
what is the class called? My teacher is going to listen to this, so I have to get the class name right.
Wait, are we doing this episode just so you can get a grade?
No, I already did my paper for this. I'm not getting a grade for this. I have to get, otherwise she's going to get mad at me for...
What is the name of your class?
The name is Introduction to Literary Study.
Introduction to Literary Study. Mm-hmm. And why did you read this particular story? Besides the fact that this particular story is just ripe for an analysis and sort of picking it apart bit by bit.
Well, the story is in the textbook that we got for the class, which I have to imagine is part of it. I also think, and she will correct me if I'm wrong in the conversation we have about this episode afterwards.
Okay.
That she likes the story.
Yeah.
She talked a lot about it in class, and I appreciated that.
A lot of people like this story.
Mm-hmm.
They say that it's a much anthologized story, but I'm looking at the number of anthologies it's actually been in, and I have seen much longer lists of anthologies for a short story, for some of the short stories we've covered on this show.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, one of our like entire quarantine adventure was a book of short stories.
So what's the name of the book it's in? Is it the Riverside Anthology of Short Fiction?
No, it's a textbook.
Is it The Story and Its Writer, An Introduction to Short Fiction?
No, it's The Norton Introduction to Literature by Kelly J. Mays.
Is it The Riverside Anthology of Short...
I have the book on the screen.
So it's the Norton one, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
The 13th... Portable 13th edition.
The portable 13th edition. Ooh.
You see how portable this is?
I mean, in the sense that you can pick it up and carry it somewhere, it's definitely portable. So this story that we are discussing. Oh, by the way, I'm Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And
it's Del Toro time.
It's Del Toro time, and this story that we're covering is Where Are You Going? Where Have You Been? It's Where Are You Going, comma, Where Have You Been? Question mark. But it's also been published as Where Are You Going? Question mark. Where Have You Been? Question mark. So, you know, however you want to say it, I guess it's been used both ways.
I think the comma in between the two implies that there's a question mark at the end of both of those.
Mm-hmm.
It's just written because it's one fluid sentence.
Now, this was first published in Argosy magazine in 1966. Argosy being, of course, a magazine that published short stories. That's what it specialized in. I actually tried to find a copy of this magazine because you know how obsessive I am about like comparing and contrasting the original publication of a story to like how it appears in anthologies, because there's frequently unexpected deviations from the original text. But I could not find a copy of this online anywhere, so I guess we're gonna have to trust Oates.
You could have gone to the library.
For an old copy of Argosy magazine from 1966?
You gotta go to one of those libraries that you see in movies all the time that just have all of those things.
With microfiche?
Yeah.
Yeah. I wish. I wish I'd had the wherewithal to do. I wish I'd had the get up and go to do that. The old gumption to seek out a copy of a story that is probably exactly the same as it was. And how you see it every single time, because this story has been picked apart by everyone. So Willow, what can you tell me about Joyce Carol Oates herself?
So to be fair, a lot of the class spends time on the stories and things like that. And we talked a bit about the history behind this one because it's so important. But I don't know all that much about her as a person.
So, I mean, Joyce Carol Oates is... As far as like Western letters go, I consider Joyce Carol Oates one of the like grand masters of Western literature, like a name that just sort of permeates all of all of Western literature, specifically fiction, but even like essays and, you know, nonfiction and poetry and playwriting and every genre you can possibly imagine. I mean, this is a woman who has been up for and won O. Henry Awards, Bram Stoker Awards. She's been up for the Pulitzer Prize 5 times, National Book Awards. Mm-hmm. Norman Mailer Prize. She has been up for and won so many awards over, wow, like almost 70 years of writing. Mm-hmm.
She was also a teacher for 35 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Awesome.
She's written 50 novels under her name. And then a number of other novels, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 novels under the name Rosamund Smith, and 3 novels under the name Lauren Kelly. That's not to mention her dozens of collections of short stories she's put together. And she's very careful about how her short stories are presented. She tends to group them by theme. Tons of novellas. Young adult fiction, children's fiction, like I said, plays, essays, memoirs, poems. She never stops writing. For a while there, she was publishing a novel a year. So yeah, Joyce Carol Oates.
She sent her first novel off to be published when she was 15.
Mm-hmm. Probably for the best that it wasn't published.
I can't imagine wanting anyone to read any of my 15-year-old self's writing ever.
Yeah, but you know, I'm sure that the disappointment of not getting published didn't stay with her very long as she suddenly started publishing novel upon novel upon novel. She's known for feminist literature and literature that tackles the position of a woman in society, like within the era in which she's writing. But she's also done a lot of horror She's a huge horror writer, Lovecraftian style fiction, just stuff that's all over the place. How would you describe this short story?
Thriller.
You would say it's a thriller?
Thriller or like psychological horror.
Okay. Yeah. It's wild.
Not like terror horror really, but yeah.
It's an odd story. Mm-hmm. Like genuinely unnerving. Not because of what happens, but because of the way in which it happens. To me, at least.
I still think what happens is pretty upsetting.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah, what happens is pretty upsetting. But to describe the actions of the story to someone is not to explain this, like to describe the story to them.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's weird and trippy. And who is this guy? What is this guy?
I think he's a monster.
Is he a monster?
I don't think he's human.
Joyce Carol Oates herself said that Arnold Friend, the guy we're referring to, is death. He is the elf knight of the ballads. He is the imagination. He is a dream. He is a lover, a demon, and all that. I want to call attention to this synopsis on the Internet Science Fiction Database. The synopsis begins with the most incorrect sentences in the history of sentences. It says, the adventure-seeking rural teenager Connie takes to picking up boys at a restaurant. She attracts the attention of a man in a gold convertible, Arnold Friend. He arrives at her house and proves to be older than she thought and very frightening. He tries at length to talk her into getting into his car with him.
What the hell?
I mean, kind of? I guess, like, kind of that's what happens? He tries at length to talk her into... It's just a friendly old chat. It's just a real bantery short story. A real back and forth. A lot of witticisms tossed around. So why don't you give us a rundown of what this story is actually about?
The story is about a 15-year-old girl named Connie.
Mm-hmm.
She has a tumultuous relationship with her family. Her mom is consistently comparing her to her sister. Her father is an absent figure in her life. And we don't learn much about her sister, just that she's about 10 years older. Strangely enough, the same age difference between me and Mitzi.
Yeah, don't think I didn't think about that. I was trying to figure out which one of you was the Connie.
Well, given the fact that I never leave my house.
That doesn't say anything. Which one of you is the Connie?
And I don't know. I mean, I think it could go either way. It really depends on the situation. Anyways, she has a tumultuous relationship with her family. Her friends seem to have similar relationships with their fathers, and this is important because of something I'm going to talk about later. I wrote a paper on this story, by the way, not that long ago, which is why I have so much to say about it. And she seems to, like a lot of teenage girls, enjoy rebelling against her parents, which leads to her going to a sort of diner by a mall and flirting with the older guys from her school there, which eventually draws the attention of Arnold Friend, who she is quite freaked out by even at first. She's clearly not happy with him looking at her. And it ends with him showing up to her house, and the ending is sort of up for interpretation about what really happens, but he freaks her out and sort of threatens her family and tries to convince her to go with him. He also has another person with him that I think is important to note.
Yeah, in the car. And this is like, even like that kind of rundown of the, like that kind of synopsis leaves out the weirdness of the situation. The fact that his car is bizarre, it's covered in weird symbols, it's covered in words, including his name. He makes strange gestures. He knows what her family is doing without being there. Like, he seems somewhat omniscient. He seems like an artificial person at times. She recognizes pieces of him. He's a bad liar.
Yeah.
His legs don't work properly.
The entire time I was writing my essay, I was doing my best to stop myself from going on a tangent about how this guy was obviously a fairy.
Yeah, there's a lot of that in it. And when she says that, when she says, like, he's the elf knight of the ballads. He's like a fairy creature. I like that she says he's imagination, he is a dream, he is a demon, he is death. Like, yeah, he is something that does not work in our world. Yeah.
Unfortunately, my essay was already going off in so many different places that I couldn't add that in.
Yeah, so let's talk about the character of Connie. I know that Joyce Carol Oates came under a lot of... This is an early story for hers. This is 1966. This is an early Joyce Carol Oates story. And I think it's the first story of hers listed on the Internet Science Fiction Database. Like, I think it's the first genre story that they list of hers. She came under a lot of heat, a lot of criticism for this story when she first published it. People said that it was critical of Connie, that it was about like a warning for young women, like to not do these things. Like, look what happens to the bad girls. Look what happens. Which, of course, Joyce Carol Oates, you know, has always been like, that's not the point of this at all. Like, she doesn't write prescriptive fiction. She doesn't. She said it was a reflection of what girls face in society. Like, it's a reflection of reality. How do you feel about that?
I'm gonna pull up my essay real quick because I said some things in it. Yeah, you're gonna get to hear my academic writing.
I'm gonna get to hear academic writing. Oh no, it's like one of those. It's like I'm at a college party. This is the academic equivalent of someone pulling out their guitar and playing Wonderwall.
Yeah. Well, don't worry. I won't be talking too much. So what I said was, this story is a story about the expectations that family and society place on a new teenage girl, and about how little control they have over. Well, I said we because I was talking from the perspective of someone who has been a teenage girl in the past year. it's the depths of what it means to be a teenage girl and how little control we have over our own bodies. Alongside that, we get to explore monsters, men, and deception, and that characterizations are really heavy. This story is about characters. It's not about setting or plot, really, but it's very much about character. Yeah. And I think that that's important because I think that a lot of times in fiction, girls like Connie are punished for being the way they are. And I can see how people would read this and think this is just another story telling teenage girls that they're going to be punished for being teenage girls. But I think that looking deeper into it, it's really a story of this is what is happening. Like, people read this story, and when we were talking in class about it, it really hit me because everyone was saying that in the end Connie chooses to go with him, and I didn't read it that way at all. I did not read it as if she had a choice, that she made the decision to join him, whether it be because of the threats or not, because to me she didn't have control of her own body in the end anymore.
Right.
She wasn't able to be her own person. She was completely isolated by her family, and eventually was her own body was taken away from her. I think I compared it a bit to myself. I'm still so mad over Dracula, over the injustice in Dracula to, I think her name was Lucy, Lucy's character. I think I compared it to that a bit in my head as well. To me, this is another story about teenage girls being blamed for being teenage girls. And maybe it hit heavy for me because I was once a teenage girl, Connie's age.
Yeah.
And I knew people who were like Connie, and that was fine. I mean, they're teenage girls. They're going to do what they're going to do. And I'd never thought that I just can't put any of the blame on Connie's shoulders in this story.
Right. And I don't feel like Oates was putting any blame on Connie.
Mm-hmm.
To me, what it felt like, and, you know, and having read some of what she had to say about it and what other people have said about it, is it the strong sense was, you know, Connie was, you know, a rebellious teen in a rebellious time. I mean, this is the this is the mid-60s, and things are, you know, the generation gap is widening, and things are getting a little looser, and society is getting a little, like, more experimental. And her sister sort of represents, like, sort of the old way of of what was acceptable for young women. And Connie is pushing against that. Like, she's now in this new age where she's trying new things. And it feels like what Joyce Carol Oates is saying, at least in part, is the Connies of the world can push and push against the expectations of society. But in the end, they are still going to be expected to comply with the monster who pulls up in the convertible. Like, you're still going to have to succumb to this thing, because that's what society, like, it's more powerful, like, it's unfair, and it's more powerful than you can possibly hope to fight against. There was something so inevitable about it by the end. Like, no matter what she tried to do, because Arnold Friend pulls up and he starts demanding she come with him. And at first he's, like, cajoling, and then he's threatening. And first he tells her that he's her age, and then it's clear that he's in his 30s. But, like, his hair looks weird. His face looks weird. Like we said, his legs don't work right. It's almost like he's he's something in a person suit. It reminds me a lot of, because of the shows I listen to. It reminds me a lot of the stories that people relate who have encountered, like, Men in Black or Greys, or had what they consider, like, Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, or even people who've experienced interactions with what they consider, like, fairy folk or whatnot. Whether you believe in it or not, the story is very similar. It's like a creature that is presenting, or the black-eyed children, a creature that is presenting itself as human, even though it's not fooling anyone, but it's working so hard to be human. And I don't think that's, as Joyce Carol Oates says, like, this guy isn't real. He represents everything. I found the story terrifying. Like, genuinely unnerving. Like, I felt bad after reading it, but in, like, a good way. Read a good story way.
I think that I actually wanted to talk to you about that, because you are my father, and I have a lot to say about the father figures in this story. So this story, the thing that stuck out to me the most was A, Arnold Friend, but B, the relationship between him and the father figure of this story.
Yeah.
There's two fathers in this story. There's her friends and there's hers. And I combine them into one character because they're basically the same character.
Yes.
They're both quiet, absent, and don't seem to care about what's going on in their teenage daughter's life. And I think that looking at that and looking at Arnold Friend's interactions with Connie, seeing a weird sort of, this is the male attention that she has been trying to get from the older guys in her school, because she doesn't have a solid father figure in her life. There's the phrase daddy issues, which always seems to be used against women who are promiscuous or just out there a lot.
Yeah.
Which I hate, because it always seems to insult the women versus the absent father figures. And I think that Arnold Friend represents, at least to her, or to me, this sort of, you want this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this is everything you want, but I'm turning it against you.
Yeah.
And the way that he threatens her father, and also refers to the house she's living in as her father's house throughout their confrontation.
Yeah.
it sort of seems like he can't cross the threshold because she still, quote, belongs to another man.
Hmm.
I don't know. I thought that there's a lot of stuff to be said about fathers in this.
No, that's something that I really hadn't even picked out. Like, amidst all the dense nature of the narrative. This is a short story too.
Mm-hmm.
It's a quick read, but every single sentence is packed with meaning. Her relationship with her father, her relationship with, I believe, Eddie, the boy that she kind of goes out with a few times.
Yeah.
She goes out with this one young man, Eddie, who's like a nice enough mm-hmm. guy. She makes out with him. They may have go a little further than that. It's the story, even though it is very much has an undercurrent that's very much about sex, is not explicit mm-hmm. in any way. But
I don't know. It gets pretty explicit between her and Arnold at the beginning there.
At the beginning?
No, like when he starts talking to her, he says some things that I was like,
he gets pretty
icky.
It's a good literary term. No, I agree. But it's not the narrator herself, Joyce Carol Oates, is not mm-hmm. the story isn't lurid at all in the beginning.
Yeah.
And then she sees Arnold Friend while she's on a date with Eddie.
Mm-hmm.
And he mouths to her like, I'm going to get
you. He says, I'm going to get you.
Yeah, I'm going to get you. And you don't really know if it's a threat or if it's a promise or what it is. Like, and she doesn't encounter him for a long time. She's staying at home. Her family goes off to a barbecue. Mm-hmm. And Arnold Friend pulls up in his golden car.
This is where you were like, who would be Connie in this situation?
Right, right. Yeah, she's at home chilling. She's having a pretty good day.
Yeah, she washed her hair.
Mm-hmm.
She danced.
She danced around. Yeah, she kind of just enjoyed being alone, and she started even having like nice thoughts about her mom.
Mm-hmm.
Like she was like, you know, like my mom goes through a lot. You know, like, she's annoying, but she still does a lot for us. She's kind of like, yeah, she's kind of settling into the home, and that's when Arnold Friend pulls up and is like, "You're coming with me. Get into my magic car or whatever."
I think it's important to note that the car is gold.
Yeah.
I think that's a very important part of this story.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's painted gold.
Right.
And it's sort of like, ooh, look at all this shiny stuff. Don't concern yourself with anything else happening.
Yes. Except for the weird numbers he spouts.
And also the weird creep in the back of the car.
Right. He pulls up with a guy. What's the guy's name? Ellie?
Ellie... something 60s.
Yeah.
Who's also creepy and is just listening to music.
Just listens to music the whole time, keeps turning up the radio and they're both wearing sunglasses. And mm-hmm. she's not really sure where any of the guys are looking at any point in the story. Yeah, and he says like there's this exchange where he says, "Listen, Betty Schultz and Tony Finch and Jimmy Pettinger and Nancy Pettinger," he said in a chant, "Raymond Stanley and Bob Hutter," and she interrupts him. She goes, "Do you know all those kids?" And he says, "I know everybody." And then she's like, "How come we never saw you before?" And he says, "Sure you saw me before. You just don't remember." And he uses all these weird expressions that are kind of dated and out of date. And then he makes an X in the air. He draws an X. He says, "This is my sign." He draws an X in the air, and it's almost visible to her. Like in the like, there's so much weird stuff going on. Like he chants numbers at one point. There's all these things that seem like they should be clues to decipher, like as a reader, but they're not. Like they are seemingly random. It's the wildest encounter.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like an alien encounter. Like it's just that weird.
He does have a UFO on his car, doesn't he?
He does. He does. He says, like, "Man the UFOs" or whatever. "Man the flying saucers." Maybe he's an alien.
It's like, maybe. I don't think he's an alien. That would be too boring.
Maybe this is an abduction. It does read like an abduction scenario, like an alien abduction. That's what's so wild about it. Like, I listened to enough stories of alien abduction that is what this sounds like. Although I know it's not because Joyce Carol Oates wasn't writing that.
She wasn't like, the truth is out there.
No, and like, I think that speaks to the inherent, there's an inherent nature of what to humans is unnerving. And that sort of goes through all of society, all like history. Like whether you believe, like, whether you're from a culture that believed in fairy, whether you're from a culture that believed in ghosts or aliens or what have you, the boogeyman.
Uncanny Valley.
You what?
Uncanny Valley, the Uncanny Valley effect. That's what this story is all about.
Yeah, it's like he's almost a person, but he's not quite.
And the longer you look at him, the more you're like, what is that?
What is that? Why is this thing talking to me? There's that part in the book Communion by Whitley Strieber where he looks out the window and he keeps seeing an owl outside his window before he gets abducted. And he's like, it's an owl. And he starts becoming terrified of owls and he doesn't know why. And you realize later it's because he's seeing the alien, but his brain only translates it as an owl. And it's almost like her brain is telling her this is a young guy because it won't really let her see what it is, which, you know, could just be that she's staring her future in the face. Like she's staring the inevitability of society in the face. And she's trying to put a young face on it, but it's just the same old violent grossness. I don't know. It's what a story.
I think that it's interesting that they chose to have him be an old man masquerading as a young man.
Uh-huh.
I say they, that she chose.
Right. They.
Because, again, back to my father figure thing. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I just, that's what I got from this. The whole, like, looking for attention from young guys, but really craving attention from your own old man.
Yeah.
Like, it's just that sort of reach. I got to that conclusion from that.
You said that you found special significance in the presence of Ellie, the other guy.
Mm-hmm.
What do you find significant about him being there?
I think that it would be threatening had he shown up alone.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that he shows up with another man who clearly isn't. This goes back to the history that this is based off of.
Okay.
Because I don't think we've mentioned it yet, but this
not
is
yet.
Based off of, yeah. Should we now? Is this a good time? Because I can come back to this.
No, I think that this is a good time to mention the fact that this is not, I think based on is a strong way of putting
it's, I don't want to say inspired by.
It's suggested by.
Yeah, I think that there's, I think that it's, yeah, it's suggested by the, they say serial killer. I think he only had 3 victims.
That's your cutoff for being a serial killer.
But there was a potential for another one. I think he confessed to that they never proved.
Right, and there were other. There's a suspicion that he may have been involved in many more.
Yeah, but the first one that he was like the first one was the killing of a high school student named Aileen Rowe.
Mm-hmm.
She was taken to a desert by him and a friend.
Yeah.
And his friend's girlfriend, who was in the car while this was happening, and killed by 2 men. And I think that that's sort of why that having the second person there was so significant to me.
Yeah.
Because it magnifies the threat, and also it's avoiding one man is hard enough.
Mm-hmm.
But I think if someone approached my house, tried to coax me into their car, while not even hiding the fact that there was another dude there who was just as weird and off-putting, I think that that would raise my alarms way more than just one guy showing up. Obviously, that would raise my alarms, but I think I would immediately probably, like, threaten to shoot them.
So this guy Charles Schmid, who was the, he was known as the Pied Piper of Tucson.
Yeah. Which I want to talk about the end of this.
Yeah, there had been a very famous article about him that got published in a magazine or the paper. I can't remember where Joyce Carol Oates first saw it. I think Life magazine, maybe. And Joyce Carol Oates saw it, and she didn't write a story about the murders. She wrote a story using it as kind of a jumping off point. But if you look at a picture of Charles Schmid, the guy was wild. Like the photo of him on Wikipedia is one of the most bizarre things. He would cover his face in makeup, and he drew a fake mole on his face. He created his own prosthetics to change his appearance because he wanted to look like a young guy. He wanted to look like a cool teen, and instead he looks like a nightmare. But if you look at him, you can see where someone might at first glance look at this guy and be like, oh, it's a good looking guy. And then the more you look at him, the more you're like, wait, there's something terribly wrong with this man.
Yeah.
Just a strange individual. And yes, he killed at least three people, maybe four, maybe more. It's a horrific murderer. Yeah, it sucked. So you had said to me that this story, Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been, is a far more satisfying way of using a true crime story to tell a story than the infamous story that we read during...
The Whimper of Whipped Dogs.
Yes, The Whimper of Whipped Dogs. Why does this one work better for you than The Whimper of Whipped Dogs?
I think it's because it doesn't use... it doesn't use a tragedy to tell people that the witnesses or the victim were at fault for what happened to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that it doesn't take someone else's story and create a monster out of it.
Yeah. Yeah, even though it kind of does. Like,
but it this is Connie's story.
Right.
This isn't the story about someone who's beat down and eventually... I guess to me, this isn't the story about someone who gives herself up to the monster of reality.
Yeah.
Because I don't think Connie gives herself up. I think that's an unfair... I don't care what the author has to say about it, to be completely honest. I don't think Connie had a choice.
Mm-hmm. I think that's exactly what Joyce Carol Oates is saying.
Yeah. And I think that... I guess what really rubbed me the wrong way was hearing over and over again people being like, Connie choosing to go with blah, blah, blah. And I think that... Because I think that saying that really wipes away the fact that Connie is a victim in this scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And that teenage girls are victims and they're not the masters of their own fate.
Right.
And The Whimper of Whipped Dogs is very much like, you either are a victim or you are a monster.
Yeah.
And if you are a victim, too bad.
Right.
Because you're going to become a monster in the end anyways.
Yeah, Whimper of Whipped Dogs, which we both disliked.
Yeah.
It sort of, it had that, because it kind of did the same thing. It took a true crime story, a horrific crime, and sort of extrapolated it into more of a bigger statement on society. But it sort of lorded it over the reader and was kind of just like, yeah, we are all guilty here. This is a degenerate world. Whereas Oates is really focusing on... Yeah, on the victim and on women and and you not, I don't know, there's just something about, I totally agree with you. There's something about the way Oates handles it that is, it's just a much defter hand.
It also might be the fact that she's a woman. She is a woman.
She is a woman.
She's a woman writing about female adolescence, which, and was it Harlan Ellison?
Yeah.
Writing about a sexual assault victim who stays with her abuser because she has nowhere else to go and then prays to the overlord in the sky and rips some guy apart.
I'm going to go on record, and this might be controversial. I'm going to go on record and say that Harlan Ellison might not be the best person to be writing about serious women's issues. I'm gonna take the controversial stance that the best writing about women was probably not done by Harlan Ellison. Yeah. So take with that what you will. Sorry, listeners. So this story had a movie based on it, if you can believe it.
Didn't they like change the ending to make it a happy ending or something?
It's not just that they changed the ending to make it a happy ending. Like it's a completely different story. It's inspired by Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been. It's called Smooth Talk. It's directed by Joyce Chopra and stars Treat Williams and Laura Dern, which is pretty awesome.
Laura Dern.
You know her from Jurassic Park.
Okay.
You know her from Blue Velvet. This is actually the movie she did right before Blue Velvet. You know her from Mask. You know her from Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore as Girl Eating Ice Cream Cone. you know her from Star Wars: The Last Jedi.
Yes. Okay. I was wondering why I'd heard her name, and it's because I was watching a video about someone complaining about people complaining about her in that movie.
She plays Vice Admiral Holdo. Laura Dern is an amazing actress, and it's just she was in this movie called Smooth Talk. Treat Williams played Arnold Friend. She played Connie, and Smooth Talk, from what I've read about it, because I have not watched it, has its own things to say about its own agenda, and it sort of uses where are you going, where have you been, as kind of the jumping off point, and then it goes off and does its own thing. It's still an ambiguous sort of thriller, but it's doing its own thing, and so I don't even think it's worth like even a comparison because it, you know, this is a very short story. It's one scene.
Yeah.
So also has Mary Kay Place. It has William Ragsdale in it as Jeff.
We're not here to talk about Smooth Talk.
It's got a lot of people in it now that I'm looking at it. A much bigger cast than Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been?
There's how many people would you need to cast for this? You'd need to cast people for the friend group.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's like four of them in it. You'd need to cast someone to play both fathers. That's right. Six. The mother and the sister. You need to cast someone to play the annoying high school guy that they turned down the first time.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd need to cast someone to play Eddie. You need 13 people.
You would need the most brilliant performer to play Arnold Friend. Would need someone. I don't even know how you would play that, because that's just that. I don't know what you would do. I know that you can get your mom to watch Smooth Talk because it stars Treat Williams. And I know for a fact that your mother loves Treat Williams.
I don't want to watch this movie.
Has Treat Williams. Just tell your mother, though. Has Treat Williams in it.
Just got back from Ragnar, so she'd probably be like, what?
Treat Williams. Your mom's favorite movie used to be Hair, starring Treat Williams. So it's any
still
case,
her favorite movie.
What?
Still her favorite movie.
Oh, good. Treat Williams. So it had a movie, you know, loosely based on it. It's been in every single collection. It will live forever, even though Joyce Carol Oates has gone on to write many more equally and even more dark stories than this. She based her novel Zombie on the Jeffrey Dahmer murders, and it is an upsetting book. So this was just her first foray into, I'm going to use this as a jumping off point for an even more distressing tale story. So do you have any final thoughts on Where Are You Going, Where Have You Been?
I think that her nod to the serial killer, the Pied Piper of Tucson, as he's called, with him being fully capable of luring her out of her home in sort of a hypnotic state is very fascinating. I also think that I talked a lot about dissociation, because I have moments where I completely dissociate from reality, and it's like I'm watching my body do its own thing. I think that she describes it really well.
Yeah.
And I also think that my conclusion from this story was that Arnold Friend was some sort of monster in disguise, and that Connie is still stuck in the house as opposed to being in her body.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that my interpretation is along those lines. I don't even feel it's even that concrete to me. Like, it's a story more about the feelings it provokes and the ideas that it puts forth. It's not. It reminds me. It reminds me of The Shining, in the sense that it's a story about a person who is trapped by the sort of inevitability of something that's out of their complete control now. I don't know. It reminds me of that. The fact that the horror exists kind of out of time and space. And
this story could definitely fit into the King verse if it tried.
Yeah. Yeah. If it tried, not even very hard.
Yeah.
Joyce Carol Oates, she's in her 80s now, and she is extraordinarily active on Twitter. So she's not always the most hip person on Twitter. She said a few things.
No, we're not going to talk about it.
No, she said a few things that like people are like, Joyce. But again, she's in her 80s, and like, I don't know. I tend to give people a little more leeway when it's like, Yeah.
You're going to be dead soon anyways. Who cares?
Yeah. It's not that. I think she has a lot of smart things to say. But
yeah. No, no. I was joking.
Yeah, she's kind of stuck in her, you know, she's kind of stuck in a place. But she's still, I think she's still an amazing writer. She still continues to write and publish, and more power to her. Yeah, check out some of her other horror writings. She's compiled her own horror anthologies of other people's writing. She loves a spooky tale. So this was a host requests episode. If you want us to request our own episodes in the future, let us know.
We already requested the next series that we're doing, that so I don't think they have to let us know.
And then our next series, of course, will be I believe it's going to be
Nightmare Alley.
It's going to be our Nightmare Alley series, which is going to be like in November. So hold up for that one. But in the future, coming up next, we have a movie coming up that I'm looking forward to, a film that I have not seen before. Do you know what it is? A film I have not seen before. We are going to be watching 1981's Dead and Buried, directed by Gary Sherman, whose work I'm not familiar with, starring a bunch of people I am not familiar with, but several people I am familiar with, including Jack Albertson, who played...
I was going to say Jack Black, and I got excited.
Jack Albertson, who played...
What was the guy's name?
What
Gary
guy?
Sherman?
The director?
Yeah.
Gary Sherman. I'm trying to tell you, it has Jack Albertson in it, who played Grandpa Joe in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Great. I have a lot of things to say about Grandpa Joe.
Charlie!
You're not aware of Gary Sherman, the guy who directed Poltergeist 3?
I am aware of Poltergeist 3. I am aware that of his movies, Poltergeist 3 is ranked third best on Letterboxd.
Oh, no.
Below Death Line, which I've never heard of, and Dead and Buried, which is the top one. I have never seen Death Line. I have seen Poltergeist 3. It is a poltergeist that takes place in a tall building. It's not very scary. And the actress who played Carol Ann, the little girl, died either right before or right after it came out. Someone died after each Poltergeist movie came out. I mean, obviously, someone dies after every movie comes out. Like, that's the way time works. But one of the main cast members of each Poltergeist movie died right after each Poltergeist movie came out.
You haven't heard of 1979's Mysterious Island of Beautiful Women?
Mysterious Island of Beautiful Women, I have not heard of.
You haven't heard of After the Shock, 1990?
After the Shock from 1990? Are you referring to the movie starring Yaphet Kotto from Alien? Scott Valentine from Family Ties? And Rue McClanahan from The Golden Girls? Are you talking about that after the show? Yeah, I'm looking at the credits. I don't know anything about it.
Have you heard of Amy's Book Hunt with Amy Brent?
Amy's Book
Hunt? 2012.
Where are you seeing this? I'm looking on Letterboxd. So those must be like...
I'm looking at his Wikipedia page. They're television
like
films.
TV movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
It looks like he did a found footage movie or something in 2006. Huh.
Wow. Have you not heard of The Legend of Bo Diddley?
I have heard of The Legend of Bo Diddley.
What about Vice Squad? He was an uncredited writer.
Vice Squad starring...
Wings Hauser.
Wings Hauser, you're right. It does have Wings Hauser.
Season Hoopley and Gary Swanson. Those are two killer names on the first two.
Wings Hauser is in a lot of stuff that I've seen. It doesn't mean his stuff is any good, but I've seen a lot of his stuff. So next week, or next time, we will be doing Dead and Buried. So get ready, my friends. I'm going to attempt to read the novelization before we talk about it. So hold on to your butts. We'll see if that happens. But otherwise, thank you so much for listening. Thank you so much for being a part of our wonderful experience here. You can find us on Twitter at Del Toro Time. Anything else to say, child?
Professor, I don't want to say your name because I don't know if you want it on the... Well, I mean, you're a professor, but I don't know if you want it in our specific circle of one person that listens to the show regularly. Mm-hmm. So if you have anything to say, tweet at us.
Tweet at us.
Or email me.
To your student. I'm not going to say
anything
else. You're
going to fail me for this.
I'm not going to say anything else because I'm not going to risk you getting a bad grade because... because of something stupid that your father will say. So we're just going to leave it at that. Clean slate. I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And we'll see you when
it's Del Toro time.
I can't believe this episode came in under an hour.